This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, how African Americans are being hit hardest in the recent surge of foreclosures and why some hospitals are calling 911 to save their patients. Joining our panel are Bob Meadows, writer at People Magazine, Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, and Laura Washington, columnist at the Chicago Sun-Times. So thanks, everybody, for being with us. And this is a huge issue. Home foreclosures on the rise around the country. Now, some lenders are taking a bath, even filing for bankruptcy. But among the issues is that 1.5 million homeowners could face foreclosure this year. And according to a new study conducted by a group of fair housing agencies, African-American borrowers in six major U.S. cities were four times as likely as whites to receive a higher cost home loan, which is just one of the many reasons why people end up in foreclosure. Latinos were also disadvantaged. So there's these subprime loans. They can overwhelm borrowers who may have lower incomes and lower credit ratings. But there's also predatory lending, offering borrowers whose credit is good enough to deserve a lower interest rate really pretty tough terms. Michael, is this something that is ripe for a government intervention at this point? And if so, what would that be?
Look, selling the American dream is something that is an American pastime, and it is not something that people do by saying that this bottle doesn't include the American dream. They label it the American dream. They don't label it snake oil. You know, we live in a caveat emptor world. All the government regulations in the world are not going to solve the problem of people not knowing how to read documents that are put before them. Not everybody is ready for home ownership, but we push home ownership. Blacks and Hispanics in particular have lower incomes and less wealth than their white counterparts. Their credit histories are different, and therefore there's that backdrop, and therefore they are more subject to predatory loans. But, you know, my mom told me a hard-to-read document is like bad food. When in doubt, throw it out.
Okay. Well, Laura, is this a situation where Michael is saying caveat emptor, buyer beware, every man for himself, I guess, is part of that?
Person.
Every person for his or herself. Excuse me. So, Laura, is that your belief too?
Well, unless you're going to accept the premise that all African Americans and Latinos are genetically disabled when it comes to reading documents and figuring out financial issues, you've got to think or got to assume that there is some chicanery going on here. As Michael mentioned, there is some snake oil afoot. These loans, these programs are designed to get around some of to take advantage of some of the lack of education, lack of access that communities of color have. So these communities for years, and not just in this program, but if you remember the FHA loan programs from the 70s and 80s, same kinds of disastrous results. These programs are targeting communities that don't have other economic options, that don't have the infrastructure in place, banks, formal savings and loans, formal mortgage companies, respected online mainline institutions. So they go to these options because they don't have the other kinds of options. There's also the issue, as I mentioned, of education. And so that allows these organizations, these predatory loan companies, many of them are very much fly by night, to come in and do a lot of disaster. I think that the issue in terms of the question whether or not we need to bail out these people, I think the issue does have to go back to the federal government, because we are supposed to have federal regulatory agencies who are supposed to be watching and protecting consumers from these kinds of programs, and I think that they've dropped the ball on this and need to be held responsible.
Bob, what is going to be the impact of lenders actually defaulting? There are lenders that are now going under. So they have their portfolio of loans. They feel they can't make a business of it anymore. Some of the smaller lenders have closed up shop and declared bankruptcy, and even bigger companies like Citibank are taking a bath. Mm-hmm. How's that going to affect the little guy?
Well, you're seeing it right now. Because we have to remember, while this was going on, say 2001, 2002, 2003, everybody was treating real estate and houses. It reminded me quite a bit of the tech drive of the late 90s that, of course, flopped eventually. This was everybody wanted into the pool. And so these subprime lenders, eventually the pool of very qualified applicants ran out. So what they did was they lowered their standards. And so you no longer needed to prove your income. You no longer had to have a credit history of 700. And they would still give you a loan, admittedly, and then all these adjustable rate mortgages that eventually are going to balloon up in payments. But what we're seeing right now is with all these people going into bankruptcy, all these lenders going into bankruptcy, these loans being defaulted on, now all of a sudden you try and get a loan, you know what? You better have your pay stubs, you better have your W-2s, you better have your credit history tight, because they're not going to make these types of loans anymore. And of course, who's going to suffer? Well, I don't know if anyone's really going to suffer, because if it means that you can't get a house that you can't really afford, I think that's a good thing.
All right. Well, let's move along to another issue, but that also has real estate implications. New Orleans. Officials say they've grown tired of waiting on the federal government to improve the city, so they're going to do it themselves. The mayor, Ray Nagin, helped unveil a $1.06 billion plan last Thursday to rebuild New Orleans. It targets 17 recovery zones for commercial development, including areas such as the Lower Ninth Ward and New Orleans East. And the city wants to depend on state funds and bonds that will be up for sale. This is part of rebuilding the territory of New Orleans. But how successful, Bob, is this going to be if there's not a federal buy-in?
Well, first of all, I have to say, good for New Orleans. Stop waiting. Take it to yourself. Do your own thing. Because if the federal government approved anything during the aftermath of Katrina, you may not really want to be relying on them to come bail you out. Can it be successful without New Orleans? Sure. But I think they actually will need federal government help to get this money, because I don't know if just selling bonds is going to do it. But I do actually applaud New Orleans for actually taking this positive, proactive step instead of just sitting back and waiting and complaining the government's not here to help me.
Michael?
I would say to Mayor Nagin, are you kidding? $1 billion is a pittance in terms of what is needed to rebuild New Orleans. You need a new town. You cannot build a new city on old, shaky levees. I'm not even certain the levees are secure yet or ready for operation. And that's the federal government's responsibility. You need insurance guarantees. And that's another federal role. You have to have capital investment. You have to have businesses who want to come into New Orleans. There is so much in terms of building a new town and building it high as opposed to low that you cannot escape federal responsibility and federal investment and federal involvement in it. And I think this is just more of Mayor Nagin's whistling.
Laura, is this a pipe dream or is this a good plan?
Well, I think it's too little, too late. As Michael points out, $1 billion is just a drop in the bucket. But where has Nagin been for the last 19 months? Now, this is the same guy who was screaming bloody murder just a few days after the disaster about the lack of federal response and the lack of federal support. So he got it, you know, back 19 months ago. But now it's taken him all these months to figure out that he shouldn't wait for the government anymore. What a surprise! Mm-hmm. But you know, there's part of the issue, and I think one of what they're trying to do with this $1 billion is leverage, because once again, the government bureaucracy gets in the way of real progress. As I understand, there's about $7 billion in the pipeline that's due New Orleans that they can't access because of something called the Stafford Act, this very obscure federal law that says that the city has to be able to prove that they can reimburse the government for the monies that come out of that fund before they can get it. So they don't have this city is destroyed financially, as you know, and economically. So they don't have the kind of money that they can put forward to guarantee the government reimbursement so that they can get the money that's already sitting there. And I think that's one reason why he's looking at selling bonds, because he has to be able to have some financial wherewithal. So one of the things I think that Congress has been looking at is trying to get that law changed, because it's sort of counterintuitive. If you're a disaster area, you don't have the money to put up to reimburse the money you need to fix the disaster area.
They don't even have enough money for law enforcement in New Orleans. You know, when you're building a new city, and this is what you have to do. You have to build New Orleans anew. That requires the involvement, participation of the federal government, state government, and the local government cooperating, working together. There has to be a single vision. There has to be a plan for housing. There has to be a plan for businesses. There has to be a plan for schools. There has to be a plan for new communities and integrated communities, making sure that the houses that are put up or repaired are not going to be houses that are shoddy and will slide down the next hurricane. This requires vision, and you need a coordinator. And I don't see how Mayor Nagin can even think that he can do this by himself with $1 billion. It's just not possible. And I'm just saying this is not just too little too late. It ain't nothing compared to what we need in terms of a new town approach.
All right. Well, in case you're just tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We were just listening to Michael Myers, the executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, Laura Washington, columnist at the Chicago Sun-Times, and Bob Meadows, writer at People magazine. You know, in the words of the philosopher Flavor Flav, 911 is a joke. That is a lyric from a Public Enemy song. I'm not saying that that's the truth, but we have all been trained to dial 911 when someone has a medical emergency. Now, some hospitals are actually dialing 911 these days. So a man in Texas died recently when he had breathing problems after spine surgery at a small specialty hospital. And some of these specialty hospitals are started by doctors to basically be boutique operations. They do very specific types of surgeries, but they don't have ER capabilities. So they're dialing 911. Mm-hmm. Should these hospitals have more of a compunction to be full service because they are essentially benefiting from doing these specialty operations? Bob, do they need to have more backup?
Well, they're a boutique, right? Not only are they specialized, but they also take the most expensive procedures and keep them for themselves. You would think that if you're going to a hospital and you get sick, that there would be someone there to take care of you. That needs to be spelled out to the patient beforehand that, you know what, you're going to come here and you may not, if anything else goes wrong other than what we're here to treat you for, you may not come out of this all right. We may have to call 911. I don't know if I necessarily need the boutiques to change because, you know, you go to get your oil changed, you're not going to get your hair done. So you know where you're going when you go to this place. You have to be aware of it, though, and that, but it just sounds so bad for a hospital to call 911. That just sounds so bad. It seems like a situation that you would never, ever want to happen and that you would need the doctors on call to be there immediately if something goes wrong. This I don't know, but it just does not sound good.
Laura, there's actually some legal precedent. Now, Congress banned new construction of specialty hospitals in 2003, saying they were taking the profits away from full-service hospitals, but the ban was lifted in 2005. Should it be reinstated?
Absolutely. I think since the ban was lifted, there's been a proliferation of 20, 30 additional so-called boutiques. And obviously, that ban should be focusing on not just the issue of competing with the fuller service hospitals, but providing adequate care. We're talking about boutique institutions here. Boutique system, first of all, the idea of boutique, that concept being connected to a hospital where you're there to save your life is bizarre. But boutique implies higher quality of service. It implies elite. It implies specialized. And you're talking about, as we've discussed, places where, as I understand it, the practice and policy is if somebody goes into an emergency life-threatening situation, you don't even, you know, don't worry about the doctors there. Call 911 immediately. I'd rather be at a regular hospital. Forget the boutique.
Michael, before I go to you, I have to give you a little story. I was moving apartments recently, and I had a bad tumble with a refrigerator, and the refrigerator won. So I ended up in the emergency room, and I spent 6 hours there because, of course, emergency rooms are shutting down all across the country, including in Los Angeles. I just needed some stitches and a little bit of TLC. But the thing is, in addition to the boutique issue, there's also the issue of what's happening in these emergency rooms. I mean, emergency rooms today, I waited 6 hours. I mean, and I wasn't by any means the worst off person there, nor did I wait the longest. What are ERs going to do if they're getting more overflow from these boutique hospitals?
There's something, a word in ER that's called triage. Apparently, this is one of your rare experiences in terms of going into an emergency room. I used to go to emergency rooms a lot when I was very poor. I'm not poor anymore. But when you have the experience with the ER, you know how to get immediate treatment based on your symptoms. That's how they see you. They see you based on your symptoms. If you have something that requires emergency treatment, they see you first. If you got an ache, you got a pain, you got a cold, you got the flu, you wait 6 and 7 hours. So one of the ways of getting to see a doctor immediately is to tell your doctor the symptom that requires them to see you immediately. But in respect to the boutique.
Hey, I was bleeding. They knew I was bleeding.
That ain't good enough. That ain't good enough. A nosebleed is not good enough. but, you know, every medical procedure, you know, every doctor knows that you do no harm. But every medical procedure has risk. I can't use the S word on NPR or any radio station. But things happen. Things happen. You can be sitting in a dentist chair and things happen. And the dentist may have to call 911 because he or she is not prepared to deal with that medical emergency. And you may not have even told your dentist the kind of medical history that you did not want your dentist to know because people hide things. Things happen. And things happen in hospitals. Even in the boutique hospitals, even in major hospitals, things happen. You go to the best hospitals and they will kill you. People who stay away from hospitals, they don't want to go to hospitals. And why people go to these hospitals, boutique or otherwise, for elective surgery, for cosmetic surgery, for plastic surgery, I say, you know, you really are putting your life at risk because not every doctor's a good doctor. Not every doctor knows how to avoid bad practices. And apparently in one boutique hospital, you didn't even have a doctor on call in a 24-hour hospital. That's dangerous. You have to know how to protect your life, how to exercise your rights as a patient. That's the first thing you do as a person who is going involved with medical procedures and doctors and professionals. Know your own rights and protect them, exercise them, and have a healthcare proxy for somebody who can exercise your rights if and when you can't.
And don't forget to bring a book to the emergency room because it could be a while.
I don't wait when I go.
That's all we've got time for. Michael Myers, Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. Bob Meadows, writer at People Magazine. They are both at NPR New York. And from member station WBEZ in Chicago, Laura Washington, columnist at the Chicago Sun-Times and the Ida B. Wells Barnett Professor at DePaul University. Thanks, folks.
Wow.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.